Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, we'll talk with the Methodist pastor who was defrocked for officiating his son's same-sex marriage, then reinstated. He's got a new book out and says the church's future depends on a change in doctrine and attitude.
But first, less than a week after the U.S. started that bombing campaign against ISIS in Syria, President Obama was asked on 60 Minutes about comments from James Clapper, director of National Intelligence, that the U.S. overestimated the Iraqi army's ability to fight the group.
I think our head of the intelligence community, Jim Clapper, has acknowledged that I think they underestimated what had been taking place in Syria.
It's being called the closest the president has come to acknowledging the U.S. was surprised by the rise of ISIS. But he didn't back off his promise to keep American ground troops out of combat in Syria. And then over the weekend, House Speaker John Boehner said this on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
At some point, somebody's boots have to be on the ground.
And if no one else will step up, you would recommend putting American boots on the ground?
We have no choice. These are barbarians. They intend to kill us. And if we don't destroy them first, we're going to pay the price.
Let's bring in NPR politics editor Charlie Mattesian. Charlie, a lot to chew on after this past weekend. What do you think of the president's comments that intelligence officials underestimated the ability of the Iraqis to take on ISIS, and by saying that, implicitly saying that ISIS was stronger than the U.S. thought?
Well, I think in some ways, Robin, this tracks back to an earlier comment the president has made that he can't seem to get past, which is the use of the term junior varsity in referring to the Islamic State some time ago in an interview, and it's placed him in something of an awkward position. The White House has tried to walk back that language and insisted that the president wasn't actually singling out the Islamic State with that dismissive description. But either way, it's left a perception that the rise of the Islamic State wasn't adequately recognized or being taken as seriously as it might have been otherwise. And so at some point, that dismissive language had to be squared with the reality of the current military action against the Islamic State. Because the president obviously needs to galvanize support behind a mission that's predicated on the very notion that the Islamic State is a serious geopolitical threat and a threat to U.S. interests in particular. And so conceding that the threat had been underestimated by the intelligence community in some ways cauterizes that public relations wound to a certain extent, but without taking direct responsibility for it either.
Well, will the president be seen as throwing James Clapper under the bus, or is it assumed that a president can only know what his intelligence officers know?
Well, I think right now you're seeing a little bit of that discussion being reflected in Congress. Senator McCain, for example, has come out with some very strong rhetoric today, essentially saying that the president has thrown Clapper under the bus and not taken responsibility for missing the rise of the Islamic State.
Yeah. Well, then we hear John Boehner say ground troops might be needed. And we know he's had closed-door meetings with the president and the administration. Presumably, he's hearing what the president is saying, that they will not be needed. Does this surprise you? And what does this mean politically?
Well, I think Boehner is reflecting fairly widespread Republican sentiment that air attacks alone are not going to be enough to destroy the Islamic State. Keep in mind, at this moment, there are very few voices in Congress who would take the discussion to the next level, which is, of course, sending U.S. ground troops. And I think if you listen closely enough to John Boehner's remarks, you'll hear the speaker address that very critical point. He raises the issue that somebody's boots will need to be on the ground, though he doesn't explicitly say American boots. What's most notable here, though, Robin, I thought, is that when pressed on the question of whether American ground troops might be necessary if no other nations step up, Boehner didn't rule it out.
Yeah. Well, there's a new poll from NBC News and The Wall Street Journal that finds that most Americans do believe 72% believe that the U.S. will use ground troops against ISIS, although Americans are divided on whether they should. So it feels as if just about everybody is thinking there will be boots on the ground except members of the Obama administration, U.S. boots on the ground.
Right. I thought that was a pretty remarkable finding to see that there was such a widely held opinion that the U.S. is going to at some point send combat troops to battle the Islamic State. And it's especially remarkable in light of the recent polling that showed the American public so strongly opposed to sending ground troops. And at the same time, you know, what we see in the polling is a very bright line. A strong majority of Americans continue to support the airstrikes, but where they draw the line is ground troops. So it's really interesting to see that the public at the same time has this level of cynicism in the back of their minds that while they oppose ground troops, at the same time, they think in the future they might be necessary.
Well, the potential ground troops oppose it as well. There's a new Military Times poll of active duty military members. It found the same number, 70% of those polled opposed to the U.S. sending a substantial number of combat troops to Iraq, in this case, to support Iraqi security forces. NPR Politics editor Charlie Mattesian, just taking a look at the tea leaves on this Monday. Charlie, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, now to a new book about a big debate within the United Methodist Church, whether a pastor who performed a marriage between his son and another man should be able to remain in the clergy. Reverend Frank Schaefer has a third and final trial in the United Methodist Church this fall. Reverend Schaefer was defrocked after telling the church court last year that he could not uphold Methodist doctrine banning gay marriage. He was reinstated by another Methodist court, and now he is preparing for the final trial before the highest court in the church. His new book is called Defrocked: How a Father's Act of Love Shook the United Methodist Church, and he joins us in our studio. And Reverend Schaefer, we've talked to you before, but this book goes deeper into a lot of things, including what it was like when your son first came out to you, which kind of started all this. Tell us about that experience.
It was a very emotional experience, both for my wife and myself, and of course also for my son, Tim. But the way he came out was that I received an anonymous phone call from a lady in the community. She said, "Reverend Schaefer, this is very important. I don't want to identify who I am, but this is a very important message. I know that your son is struggling with this sexuality. He is gay, and he is also entertaining thoughts of suicide." And that began a little bit of a drama in our family, of course, that led to many, many things, as you know. But one thing that it led to was really a searching of the heart. First of all, my wife and I were in denial. That was our first reaction. Now, Tim is not gay. We didn't see any signs.
You never thought that.
We never thought that as a possibility. And even though I was theologically tolerant already at that point, it was still a struggle for me as a father to learn that my child was gay. Well, but we didn't know at first, so we asked him. And he said, yes, it was true. He is gay. And he told us about his struggle that led to his suicidal thoughts. And it was heart-wrenching. We learned that, you know, that he went with me to a theological conference, to an annual conference in the United Methodist Church. Just so happened that year, there was a debate on the floor about homosexuality. And what he heard there was the message that he can't be gay and go to heaven. And it really thrust him into a depression and, into, quite frankly, into fear.
And you, of course, had no idea that any of this was going on.
I had no idea. He was 13, 14 years old. I didn't know he was struggling with this at all. His faith had always been very important to him. He said he cried himself to sleep many nights, praying to God, please make me, quote unquote, normal. And when that didn't happen, he thought it might be best for everybody involved, including him, if he just took his life. He was at that point. And when we heard that, my wife and I both burst into tears, and we just hugged him and said things like, we love you so much, Tim, and you did not choose this. Obviously, you did not want to be homosexual. You prayed against it, and it didn't go away. So this is how God created you. You are created in the image of God, just like everybody else, and you're beautiful, just as you are, gay and all.
So you didn't have any anger, as some parents do, when finding out something like that?
No, I did not have any anger at all. I mean, I was going through a phase when I was thinking, and I think a lot of parents of gay children go through this, when I was thinking, well, what does this mean now? This redefines all of my expectations for my son. You know, I was picturing him, and he was a very traditional guy, you know, as being married and having children. And, you know, I was looking forward to the grandchildren. I was like, oh, so I guess this means I won't have biological grandchildren from him. So it also contained an aspect of fear because Matthew Shepard had just been beaten to death 2 years prior to him coming out. And so I was worried about that. I was worried about AIDS and all of those things. But no, I was not angry. I was very much filled with compassion when he shared his story. And I just had to reach out to him. I just had to affirm him.
And it also, of course, changed your relationship with the church. Not at first, of course. You had to decide how much of this to reveal to the people that you were working with and to your parishioners.
Oh, absolutely. It was a crisis moment for me. I was questioning whether I could be working as a United Methodist minister having a gay child. And I came to the conclusion, I said, no, I am a pastor. I was ordained by this church, and I'm going to stay here. This is our faith. The Methodist faith is our faith tradition, and we're going to continue, and I'm going to try to change the church because I truly believe that the church's stand is absolutely wrong.
But at what point did you decide to go as far as being the person who married your son and his now ex-husband?
That phone call came in 2006 from my son, Tim. I immediately said yes because I honestly felt honored. And it was only after I hung up that I was thinking, uh-oh, what does this mean now for me as a United Methodist minister? Because clearly our doctrine forbids such practice. And I came to the conclusion, and that was another struggle I had to go through, but I came to the conclusion, I said, you know, if they're going to fire me, they have to fire me, but I'm going to do this wedding. So I let my superiors know, my bishop, my district superintendent, in writing that I was going to perform this wedding. And frankly, I expected a phone call in the days and weeks after that from the bishop telling me I'm done.
And it didn't come then, but 6 years later, right before the church's statute of limitations on your actions ran out, the trouble did begin for you.
That's right. 6 years, almost 6 years later, a complaint was filed against me. And it was really, it came out of my local situation, my local church situation. There was a core group of people, about maybe 20, 25, 30 people that were unhappy with some of the things I had been doing in the church. They were unhappy with my theological stance, which they correctly identified as progressive. And frankly, they wanted to get rid of me. They had tried other things. You know, they had accused me of having an affair and having had that in the church with another man. They accused me of embezzling money. There were investigations. None of those stuck. And finally, they found the smoking gun, so to speak. One of them drove all the way to Boston, Massachusetts, and got a hold of the license that I signed, the marriage license.
But why do you think they were willing to go so far as to lie about you to get rid of you?
Yeah, I still ask myself the same question. I was their pastor for 11 years. I was there in their moments of joy and in their sad moments, and I consider them friends still to this day, many of them. It was a little surprising to me, you know, to experience that much. It almost felt like hatred. And I wasn't sure why, because I'm a very pleasant person, you know. Maybe sometimes too friendly, if I listen to my wife, you know. But sometimes she feels I should be, you know, more firm in my leadership. But I'm a very democratic person. I'm a very nice person. So I don't really get it. Please, if you have an answer, give it to me because I really don't know.
Well, and your wife, by the way, was willing to leave the church at one point through all of this stress of what was going on in the trial. Why didn't you ever decide, you know what, I'm not in sync with this church anymore?
There were, on the other hand, so many good things happening at the church. We had experienced quite a bit of growth, actually, and there were many, many people that were in support of me.
But there were also a lot of people who were not in support of
me. There were also a lot of people that were not, and that group was growing, you know, as things continued to get ugly. But there were still so many good things, and I had so much support. It was interesting, but in the actual courtroom, all those in support of me sat on my side of the room, and all those against me were sitting on the prosecution side of the room. And it was really sad because it was very clear to the world that my church was completely split on this.
But in the end, you were found guilty.
In the end, I was found guilty. I was no longer able to work as a Methodist minister. You know, I knew that was coming because I had made a statement at my trial that I just felt I had to make. I was actually advised, even by my own son, on the day that I was supposed to give testimony, and he said, "Dad, just tone it down. You know, just don't lose your job over this. Don't lose your career over this." And all of my friends, even my counsels, advised me that way. They had prepared a very, very carefully crafted statement that I was supposed to read, very political, very diplomatic. And if I was going to be asked on the stand, "Will you ever perform a same-sex marriage again?" I was supposed to say, "I can't answer that question. You know, nobody can really predict the future. It's a hypothetical question," that sort of thing. But as I got closer to making that statement, I knew in my heart that I had to stand not only with my children, I have three gay children, but also with all of my LGBTQ brothers and sisters in the church that had contacted, many of them had contacted me during this time, telling me their sad stories and telling me the stories of how the church had really harmed them in so many ways, incredible stories. You know, I thought to myself, I can't do this. I can't make this statement. I have to stand with them because they've been asking this question all these years. And where is my pastor? Why is my pastor not standing with me? And so I had to tell my jury and the trial court the way I felt, and that I was not going to refuse ministry to anybody based on their sexual orientation, and that I was also going to continue with my message that the church has to stop the discrimination because it is harmful. It is harming beloved children of God. I had to tell them that. It was so strong in my heart. And you know what? After I've done it, I felt great. You know, I always related to the scripture that says, "Perfect love drives out all fear." At that moment, I was fearless. For the first time in a long time, I felt no fear. I didn't care whether people were going to defrock me or stone me to death. Hmm. You know, I felt at peace. I knew I had done the right thing.
You just mentioned that three out of your four kids are gay. What has that been like for you?
Oh, it's been a wonderful experience. And I know that sounds a little strange, but I'll tell you what, we're a very unique family. And of course, when my two other children came out, we celebrated it. You know, it was no big deal. But
I mean, it is one thing for one of your sons, your first son, to come out and say that he's gay, and you go through all the emotions of thinking about what that means for grandchildren or whatever. But then once it's three out of four, does it then make you wonder if you're going to have grandchildren?
Yeah, you know what? By that time, my thinking was totally different, and I knew that being gay it's not the end of the world. You know, you can have a very happy life,
and you can have children, by the way, of course.
And you can have children. They may not be biological, but you can have children.
But they could be biological.
And they even could be biological, absolutely. And times were changing as well. You know, it's quite a different story to live today as a gay man or a lesbian woman or transgender or bisexual individual than it was in the year 2000, for instance.
Yeah.
And so all of that changed. And I tell you what, we're a unique family because half of us are gay, half of us are straight, and we all get along with each other, and it's a beautiful thing.
Now, you have been reinstated, but there is another trial, sort of the Supreme Court of the Church, coming up in October. What are you expecting?
Yes, October 22nd, I'm going to be in Memphis, Tennessee, where our judicial council will meet and actually granted an oral hearing. This is it. The decision that's going to be made about my future by this judicial council is final. There is no appeal after that. So I'm hoping and praying that the decision they make will be a just decision and will hopefully signal a change for the future of the church.
And on the issue of same-sex marriage, do you think the church will, in 2016, when they meet again, decide to accept same-sex marriage?
I think something has to change, or our church is doomed. We're already losing the younger generation. To them, it's really a non-issue. And my feeling is that if the doctrine will not be changed, if those church laws will not be changed in 2016 at our next general conference, there's going to be a split.
Reverend Frank Schaefer. His new book is called Defrocked: How a Father's Act of Love Shook the United Methodist Church. Pastor Frank, thanks so much again for coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you.
A survey out today finds that fees that customers pay at American banks are soaring. The survey comes from Bankrate. That's a company that tracks banking fees and interest rates. And NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax is with us now from Washington with the details. Marilyn, what kind of fees are we talking about here and how bad have they gotten?
They've gotten bad. In just the past year, the average fee for an out-of-network ATM is up about 5%. And Jeremy, you know, inflation in the last 12 months is up less than 2%.
Right.
So that's a very big jump. But it's part of a trend. The fees have been surging really since the start of the Great Recession. Bankrate said in this study that they're up about 23% over the last 5 years.
Wow.
That's a lot. That's way ahead of inflation. So the average cost now for a transaction at an ATM that is not part of your bank is $4.35. And that's a new high for the eighth consecutive year. And, you know, it doesn't really end there. There are other fees, too.
Well, and overdraft fees are a big problem as well. They've gone up significantly. What's happening with those?
You're exactly right. The overdrafts have really gone up. They now average $32.74 for just one overdraft. But that sort of amounts to a new record high for the 16th consecutive year. So they may be high, but at least they're consistent.
And why is this happening? And you think about fees at airports now, all the fees that you pay when you buy an airplane ticket, fees at hotels. Why is this happening so much at banks as well?
I feel like I grew up in the land of the free, and now I live in the land of the fee.
Right.
Jeremy, you saw that coming, huh? Anyway, after the, in the 2008 financial crisis, lawmakers enacted a lot of regulations to limit these kinds of fees. You know, they wanted to cut back on what banks were charging merchants for credit card transactions and some of those debit card fees. But the more they squeezed down on certain fees, the more they were popping up in other places. So where they've really hit people is these out-of-network ATM fees and a lot of those accounting checking account fees.
I remember speaking with somebody in the banking industry about one of the practices that they used to do before those new regulations you're talking about, which is, let's say that you had three charges on your debit card, one for $100, one for $10, one for $5.
Right.
They would process the $100 one first because they said that's the most important one. And if you overdrafted on that one, you would then pay an overdraft fee on both of the other ones as well.
Yeah, there was a technical name for that. Cha-ching.
Right, exactly. So, and we just talked last week about Walmart getting into offer cheap checking accounts to its customers.
Right.
Is this what's driving that, to get the world's largest retailer in on the banking sector like this?
Yes, there are a lot of problems with these fees, and especially for lower income workers. You know, you think about that, if it's almost a $33 fee for one overdraft, I mean, gosh, you know, that means there are some meals your family's going to have to skip if you don't have that. $33 can fill the tank so that you can drive to work the next week. That's a lot of money. So there are non-banks that are trying to get into this financial sector, online companies, credit unions are trying to do a lot, but Walmart may become a big factor because it's been talking about this push into financial services where it wants to offer checking accounts that would have no overdraft fees like that, or, you know, various ways to cut the cost. So you have to think that a company as big as Walmart, reaching the number of people that they do, would have some potential impact to drive down these fees. But so far, nothing has helped much. You know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that was set up to try to help crack down on this kind of thing, last summer they put out a study that said that the average debit card transaction was just $24. But, you know, the overdraft fee was $33.
Wow, so you're paying more for the fee. Marilyn
Giewax,
senior business editor at NPR. Thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Jeremy.
After almost 6 months of indecision and tension, recounts and charges of fraud, Afghanistan has a new president.
Salam! Day!
Just a little bit of the pomp and circumstance from this morning's ceremony in which Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai, a former World Bank technocrat, was inaugurated. He'll share power with his former opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, in what's being called the first modern peaceful transfer of power in Afghanistan. But that news today was overshadowed by the announcement that the U.S. will sign a deal to keep 10,000 American troops in Afghanistan after the combat mission ends at the end of this year, when troops were supposed to leave. Kate Clark is a senior analyst with the Afghanistan Analyst Network, an independent nonprofit. She joins us from Kabul. And Kate, what more do we know about this announcement, this deal that will keep American troops in Afghanistan after year's end?
It's been on the cards for many months, Robin. Both presidential contenders, Ashraf Ghani, who's now the president, and his rival Abdullah, who's now the chief executive officer of the government, had promised that they would sign this agreement with America to keep American troops here and to keep the money and support coming for the Afghan security forces. Your listeners might remember that Hamid Karzai, the outgoing president, had absolutely refused to do this. And we understand that tomorrow President Ghani will sign the bilateral security agreement with America.
Well, we remember that in Iraq as well, the sticking point on keeping troops there, U.S. troops there, was that the Iraqi government would not agree to this status of forces agreement, which gives legal protection to American troops in foreign countries. So, first of all, was that agreed to in the Afghanistan agreement?
Yes. It's all in the agreement.
Right.
Basically, the status of a forces agreement actually still holds, and it was actually signed by Dr. Abdullah when he was the foreign minister, right in the first Karzai government. That legal protection for American troops doesn't go away. But what the bilateral security agreement does is it makes it all sort of fresh and official. Afghanistan is facing a nasty insurgency that's not going away. And the most important thing is that it's actually not the American forces or even the American support. It's actually the money going to the soldiers and police on the ground. And the key thing that everyone was really worried about was that, you know, with all these horrible, lengthy shenanigans over the elections, that America and NATO would finally give up on Afghanistan and walk away. And a state that's can't pay its army and police and facing an insurgency, it was feared was one that would not last long.
Yeah. They might have had an eye on Iraq as they agreed to this agreement. But now you have the newly inaugurated president, Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai, sharing to some extent executive powers with his former opponent, Abdullah Abdullah. But today the president called on the Taliban to lay down their weapons and join the political process. Is he offering amnesty in that comment? Because at the same time, at least 12 civilians were killed in bombings. We know some Taliban more violent than others, and you talk about this insurgency.
Yeah, I think Ghani has been very clear about what he would like to see happen. He spoke today about the need for peace if Afghanistan is to be stable. And he also spoke about the need for the state to get cleaner and stronger in terms of judges stopping taking bribes, security forces stopping behaving illegally, the government itself behaving a lot better with the people. So I think there was a real call to try and strengthen the state. And part of that was a recognition that in some way the insurgency is also driven by bad government. So it was an acknowledgement that there are some reasonable reasons why people are fighting, as well as some unreasonable reasons, if you can describe it like that. And he did speak about, you know, the people who are killing our children and elders. So it wasn't that he was holding back on describing the violence, but he's also trying to lay out a pathway by which the armed opposition groups can come back in. And, you know, some people would say that if the Taliban were sensible, they would take this opportunity. The foreign forces are leaving. Hamid Karzai is going. It's a face-saving opportunity. If they wanted to, they could come back with their heads held high. But as you said, there were, again, nasty outrages today, violence, killing civilians and others. And that at least seemed to be the first response of the Taliban to the new government in Kabul.
And one last question, Kate Clark, there in Kabul. How much is ISIS shaping what's happening in Afghanistan?
I think the rise of ISIS has at least meant that the Obama administration does not want a nasty, failed Afghan state, and that it is still willing to support the government here and what's going on. So that played to Afghanistan's advantage, probably. At least on the ground, there are two issues. One, ISIS represents somehow an ideological rival to the Taliban. The Taliban is an Afghan force. It was set up as a domestic force trying to take over control in Kabul, but always it had international partners, chief among them, of course, Al-Qaeda. At the same time, the Taliban and ISIS are very, very different creatures. ISIS is an international jihadist front. It's got very, very internationalist ideas. It's far more violent than the Taliban. The Taliban still, despite its international networks, is almost entirely focused on Afghanistan and what goes on here. And I would say that for all the war crimes the Afghan Taliban have committed, there are still some red lines which ISIS has completely gone beyond. The fear is, I guess, here that you have ISIS with a lot of money. It may try and muscle in on the insurgency here. There may be copycat influences with insurgents here wanting to copy some of the more atrocious actions, such as beheading people. I think those are what people here are worried about. Up till now, the Afghan government has at least had a partner it could talk to, and the fear if the insurgency splits or fragments is that chance to talk even gets lost.
That's Kate Clark speaking to us from Kabul in Afghanistan. She's senior analyst with the independent nonprofit, the Afghanistan Analyst Network. Kate, thank you.
Thanks very much.
It's here and now, and for the first time since winning the 1985 World Series, the Kansas City Royals are in the playoffs. They beat the Chicago White Sox yesterday and will take on the Oakland A's in a one-game wild card playoff on Tuesday night in Kansas City, ending the longest active postseason drought of any major sports team in North America. At midseason, though, it looked like Kansas City's sorry streak was likely to continue. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Greg Eklund of KCUR takes a look at the turnaround.
Sunday's regular season finale, a 6-4 victory for the Kansas City Royals over the Chicago White Sox, marked the end of an uphill journey that began in Chicago. Back in July, they came into Chicago after being swept by Boston right after the All-Star break. The losing streak reached 4 when they opened with a loss against the White Sox. That put the Royals 8 games behind the first-place Detroit Tigers in the American League Central. It wasn't what 42-year-old Royals veteran Raul Ibanez remembered when he used to play against them.
Talent-wise, it's one of the best teams in the game, and that's why I feel that the only thing to really justify the talent that's in here is to get into the postseason.
Ibanez, who joined the team in late June, conveyed that message in Chicago during a closed-door meeting. The Royals then reversed themselves by winning the final 3 games of that series. It started them rolling before it culminated with a postseason berth clinched last Friday, again in Chicago.
Obviously, that was a special moment for a lot of us.
That's left fielder Alex Gordon, the longest tenured Royal, along with Billy Butler, the designated hitter. Gordon says the message by Ibanez got through.
I think we're kind of, you know, in the dumps a little bit as far as maybe a confidence-wise, and Raul just kind of lifted us up and, you know, said what needed to be said, and which was good for coming from a guy like him.
This is only the 3rd winning season for the Royals since the strike-shortened 1994 season. But in the immediate years, following the World Series championship in 1985, the Royals were contenders. Little did Royals play-by-play announcer Denny Matthews, who has been with the team since day one in 1969, realized that it would take another 29 years for the Royals to taste postseason play again.
You wouldn't have thunk it, would you? But you're right, there were some good teams that the Royals were up against, and they just happened to prevail. And there were some obviously pretty down times and discouraging times, and the fans, I think, got a little tired of hearing, well, we're making progress, we're rebuilding, and all those things.
Chris Othick grew up a Royals fan in Calhoun, Missouri, and remains loyal to them, even if he lives a block away from Wrigley Field, the home of the Chicago Cubs.
You know, it got pretty dark there for a while. I mean, it didn't seem like there was a light at the end of the tunnel, and we kept hearing the same thing every year. I could almost relate to the Cubs fans who were hearing, wait till next year, wait till next year.
The Cubs haven't been to the World Series since 1945, so Royals fans at least have a more recent World Championship to hang their hat on. But for those who weren't around in 85, a 29-year playoff drought was hard to accept. And now they hope for a return to the World Series. For Here and Now, I'm Greg Eklund in Chicago.
And to college football now. In Saturday's game between Michigan and Minnesota, Michigan's quarterback Shane Morris took a helmet to the upper chest hit from Minnesota defender De'Aaron Cochran early in the fourth quarter. The hit left Morris wobbly, showing concussion-like symptoms, but head coach Brady Hoke did not take him out of the game.
And I got to tell you right now that number 7 is still in this game is appalling to
there
me.
There he comes.
It is appalling that he was left in on that play to throw the ball again as badly as he was hit by Cochran. And Cochran.
That's ABC analyst Ed Cunningham after the hit as Shane Morris completed one more play before being taken out. Asked after the game about a possible concussion, here's what Coach Hoke said.
Shane wanted to be the quarterback. And so, believe me, if he didn't want to be, he would have come to the sideline.
Well, Shane Morris, barely able to stand up, was eventually carted off the field. And there are now calls for Michigan to fire Coach Hoke. John Bacon is a college football analyst, author of Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. He joins us from Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. John, what did you think when you saw that hit?
What you thought, which is you don't want that to be your son. It was a targeting hit. The guy should have been out of the game at that point, the Minnesota player. But that's not the issue. And here, of course, he wobbles off. He's a pretty tough kid, obviously. He starts wobbling.
Morris,
and
yeah.
Exactly, the quarterback, Shane Morris, when by then around 70,000 or 80,000 people in the big house could all see what was happening, the question is, why could the coaches not? And that is a fair question.
Well, and why are they seeming to say it was up to the player? Aren't there guidelines? We thought that if there was a hit, it's not the player who decides if he wants to play.
There are about three failures here. The referees, first of all, they can see what's happening. They're right there. They got referees all over the field. They're supposed to stop play and get an injured player off. And from the hit alone, you could see that this was clearly a wobbly situation. I'm not a doctor, of course, but there you go. Second of all, you've got about a dozen coaches on the sidelines, including strength and conditioning. They should be able to see what's going on. Brady Hoke is right there, the head coach, who does not wear a headset and therefore is not in communication with the other coaches who can see this. And the doctors, by the way, and I know these doctors, and I've been in that sideline before for the previous book, they're very conscientious. Jeff Kucher is a neurologist who's there at every game, which is very rare in college football, actually, and a leading national expert on how all this works. And he's trying to put reforms in and so on. But I don't think Dr. Kucher ever got a chance to do his job because he's still in there the second play. And you're dead right, Robin, that it is not up to a 19-year-old quarterback who's already got his head banged by someone else's helmet to determine his own health. That is a ridiculous protocol and one that clearly failed here.
Well, on Sunday, Coach Hoke issued a statement at Reden Park that the University of Michigan has a distinguished group of certified athletic trainers and team physicians. They're responsible for determining whether or not a player is physically able to play. Coaches have no influence or authority. And today, Coach Hoke held his weekly press conference, and this is part of what he said.
I mean, we would never, ever, if we thought a guy had a concussion, keep him in the game, and never have.
You saw the coach's news conference. What do you think?
I think it was not helpful. I think that when you need a checker speech a la Richard Nixon, they blew it. That he was not prepared to answer three very fundamental questions. I tweeted these last night, not that they're watching me, of course, but first question is, why didn't Shane Morris come out after that play to at least be checked? When you're on the field that long and you're wobbling off, right, that should be enough right there to set the whole motion, the whole process in motion. When was he tested for concussion? What were the results? Here it is 2 days later, Robin, and we still have no answers to any of those questions. So at that point, you're better off not having a press conference than having one and actually be forthcoming with real answers.
Well, that was going to be a question. How is Shane Morris? Do we know?
We don't know. They still have not answered that question. So he also had a leg injury, and they're trying to pawn it off in the leg injury. I don't know if that's true or not. I know that he does have a leg injury. I'm not questioning that. But the question is, does he have a concussion? And if so, how severe?
Yeah.
So we still do not know 48 hours later what really happened.
Yeah, the leg injury from another hit. We've been having to watch that tape over and over again.
It's not much more fun than the other one, is it?
No, but John Bacon, you love college football. And we had you right after we spoke with Steve Almond, who also loves football, right. But he wrote the book Against Football, and he's trying not to watch. Just after tape like that, do you consider not watching? Where do you stand on that?
I still love college football. This is still my alma mater. Not that that's going to taint me too much on this report, of course. But look, this is the last place I thought this was going to happen. I've got in the previous book, when Denard Robinson gets a concussion, it is not debated. The doctors have complete power in that situation. In this case, they didn't get a chance to have that power because the player didn't come off. As you said, the player waved off the head coach. That is not how this is supposed to work.
John Bacon, author of Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football on that terrible hit in the Michigan game. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. John, thanks as always.
Robin, thank you.
Okay. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.